Most of the events that have taken place so far are events that took place before the Pleistocene, or what popularly we call the Ice Age. And the events which take place now are events which, because of their dramatic character, also are going to require some superlatives, but which took place primarily during the Ice Age, during the Pleistocene, and left the remaining changes that I want to talk about on the face of the landscape I've drawn here. The thing, of course, that we associate with the Pleistocene most traditionally, geologically, and popularly is the concept of glaciers. And for reasons that we don't understand entirely as yet, just to throw out one possible cause, now that it's become known that the continents are not stable, that they have been moving on the surface of the globe, perhaps as a cause for this, we're talking about the time when Antarctica reached its polar position, and by reaching its polar position, changed the reflectivity of the Earth, which would change the amount of heat absorbed versus the amount of heat lost during the course of a year, and as a result, caused a lowering of the global temperature. We don't know. That's one possibility. There are other possibilities, too. Point is that globally, on a worldwide scale, at about 4 or 5 million years ago, the snow in many portions of the globe began to accumulate to depths which were impossible to wipe out during the melting of the summer season. And as the snow gradually began to accumulate, it grew thicker and thicker, particularly up here in the mountainous areas where the mountains became blanketed. With snow, and as that snow would persist season to season, especially in the ravines, it would reach depths of as much as 100 or 200 or 300 feet, and when this thickness is reached, the crushing weight of the overlying layers of snow crystals is sufficient to cause the crystals at the base to fuse, remelt, fuse with each other, form ice. The ice then begins to behave as a plastic, and when the ice begins to behave as a plastic and to move down valley, then a glacier is born. And so they were all over the world, in alpine areas, and in our area, extending out into the central plateau of British Columbia, first as alpine glaciers, later as great spatulate Piedmont glaciers, filling the basin until the interior basin of British Columbia was filled overflowing, and there was nothing for the ice to do but simply to spill down southward, down the Okanagan Valley, all but engulfing the Okanagan Highlands, blocking the Columbia River where Grand Coulee Dam is now, extending out onto the lava flows, other flows pushed down the valley of the Columbia. In a few places, ranges stood out above the surface and down north of Spokane into the vicinity of Lake Pend'Oreille. And so the Cordilleran Ice Sheet was born, and its many extensions pushed southward down into our state. Occasionally, as in the case of Moses Mountain up to the north of us and to the east of us, we'd have a projection, what the Eskimos call nunataks, of rock sticking up above the ice. But those of you who know Omak should think in terms of the ice having been more than a mile thick at that point. Well, this, of course, had enormous effects on the landscape, too. One of those effects was simply to abrade all the weathering products of the tertiary with its warmth and its moisture and its lush vegetation off those mountain surfaces and strip them bare and clean to produce the smooth rocks that some of you saw in the vicinity of Chelan, others saw up to the north in the vicinity of Omak, or between Omak and Grand Coulee Dam. Those materials were then carried southward, and as long as the ice was advancing, they were suspended in it, including blocks the size of this room, down to particles the size of clay, that can be seen only with a microscope, where they were dumped primarily along what we call the Withrow Moraine or Mansfield Moraine in this vicinity, and there produced one of the great terminal moraines or end dumping positions of glaciers
in the world. And it too is a textbook example of this sort of thing. But with the ice there, of course, the Columbia River could no longer follow its normal course. And the obvious escape for the Columbia River was southward into this basin of basaltic lava flows that had been built during the Miocene. And so the Columbia was deflected, not from its course around the margin, but down along a course into the central portion of the plateau that resulted in erosion of an enormous canyon called the Grand Coulee that reached headward up to the point of the ice dam. The Grand Coulee included in its formation a cataract approximately a dozen times the size of Niagara, many times as high, and if you have a chance as you drive eastward across the plateau, you should stop and see it. It's now entirely dry, and those of us who talk about coulees in eastern Washington refer to areas that were cut by glacial meltwater diverted in manners like this during the Ice Age, but from which the water supply has now been removed. Dramatic as it is, Grand Coulee is only a minor thing compared to what is perhaps the most spectacular event to have occurred here during the Ice Age. And that is development of a peculiar landscape that we call channel scablands. When I took geomorphology in college and we talked about names like coulees and scablands, it really turned me off, and I thought that I certainly would never want to live in a place like that. And here I've been for 16 years. The first geologist to encounter this landscape simply borrowed the term scabland from the people who had settled it. Brown, barren tracts of basalt from which everything has been swept away, from which the rich wind-blown lus is gone, obviously produced by streams that are no longer there, with no visible source for the water that must have been of gigantic proportions, and yet these extend all the way across eastern Washington. And since no one had ever seen a landscape like that before, Doc Bretz, in his research, simply adopted the term scabland and applied the term channel to it as an adjective, and now everybody all over the world who studies these types of landforms refers to the channel scablands as they were named by the pioneers who settled them. Well, I mentioned that the Columbia had been blocked by an ice lobe. Another ice lobe was one that extended down to the vicinity of Lake Pend'Oreille. And as ice pushed down into the vicinity of Lake Pend'Oreille, it blocked off the Clark Fork at Cabinet Gorge, for those of you who know the area, of the Columbia River, which drains all the meltwater from the glaciers of the Flathead Lobe and all the meltwater from the normal precipitation in northwestern Montana. And the result of blocking off all of that water can have only one effect, to produce an enormous lake which backed up, and you can see the sediments deposited in it now around Missoula, and hence the name Glacial Lake Missoula. Glacial Lake Missoula covered thousands of square miles. It reached a maximum depth of over 2,000 feet. It's a simple matter to trace its shoreline and its depth and to calculate the volume, which would have been on the order of 400 to 500 cubic miles. And when the ice dam at Lake Pend'Oreille collapsed like that, it released 500 cubic miles of water to come roaring down across the plateau, in which since the end of the Miocene there had not been more than 8 to 10 inches annual precipitation. There hadn't been a stream big enough to carve a canyon worthy of the name, and so it simply, and the only canyon available to it, was already blocked by ice at Grand Coulee Dam. So the ice, or so the water from Lake Missoula simply went where it could, spilling from one canyon to another, across the plateau, around the old anticlinal ridges, from one series of stream channels into another, into the Columbia. Finally, out to the vicinity of Portland, where it built a delta that is now 300 feet above sea level. Advantage, the water was 700 feet deep. if we take the if we calculate the velocity of the initial bore of water from the diameter of the boulders that it moved, the initial wall of water rushing across the plateau must have been traveling at speeds on the order of 50 to 100 miles an hour. The total time this event could have lasted would have been 2 weeks. But that's all the longer you can sustain a discharge of that magnitude with a volume of 500 cubic miles to pass through a drain the size of Cabinet Gorge. We know now that this happened several times during the Pleistocene. It was enough when Bretz first recognized the possibility in the early 20s to suggest that it happened once. Remember yesterday I pointed out that a young man named Scopes was essentially martyred in Tennessee for having dared to teach that the Bishop of Usher was incorrect in suggesting the earth was formed 4,004 B.C. at 9 o'clock in the morning of October the 24th, and that Charles Darwin may have had some ideas to contribute in terms of the development of life on earth. This was just at the time, in spite of the fact that Scope personally lost, the old ideas of catastrophism, of the earth being rent asunder to produce canyons, mountain ranges being thrust up in the wink of an eye, this old idea of catastrophism was really once and for all killed by the Scopes trial, which pointed out the ridiculousness scientifically of taking that sort of viewpoint. And here, almost to the year of Scope's trial, Bretz had the chronological misfortune and the audacity to suggest a catastrophism to produce the canyons of eastern Washington. And as one might expect, he was met by enormous rejection of his ideas in what became one of the most famous controversies of geomorphic science in the United States in the last half century. The battle raged to the point where, after decades, Bretz felt he had said his piece, would show no more fight, simply held his peace while he was bombarded with attacks from all quarters. At the Geological Society of America meetings in Seattle just before World War II, the rumor went around that a group of level-headed scientists from the Eastern schools, none of whom incidentally had done much field work in Eastern Washington, were going to come out on the field trip that Bretz was to lead out onto the Channel Scablands and set the story straight to put the old man in its place. Day before the meetings ended, an old man named J.T. Pardee, one of the old-time geologists who had mapped the Caldwell Indian Reservation out here, the size of the state of Delaware, in 3 summers with a pack string of 17 mules, and who had mapped a good share of western Montana in the same way, had gotten hold of some of the first aerial photos taken. And he had noticed that around the margin of Glacial Lake Missoula, there were curious sinuous ridges that lined up all toward 80 Narrows, which happens to be the place where, if you pulled the cork on Lake Missoula, the water would drain out. And that these sinuous ridges looked exactly like the little ripple marks you get when you pull the plug on your bathtub after a day out in the field and forget to slosh the water out while you're drying off, and you have to go back and do it later on. And there they are, all lined up around the inlet. Only these ridges are 200 feet from crest to crest and 15 to 20 feet high, and they're made out of cobble gravel. And that locally they form deltas with boulders bigger than this fireplace, implying velocities on the order of 50 miles an hour. So Pardee got up, and without mentioning the Channel Scablands, presented a paper with, I think, the most beautifully understated title that anyone will be likely to achieve. He called it Unusual Current Ripple Marks at the Outlet of Glacial Lake Missoula. And for the first time in almost 40 years, of scientific argument, it was obvious that there was a source of water sufficient to have produced the raging torrents that must have cut this landscape. And at the end of the meeting, everybody packed up and went on the field trip to eastern Washington with old Doc Bretz to find out how the Scablands really formed in the old master himself. Well, for those of you who've driven across eastern Washington, you've had a chance to see that. I've got just a few minutes left. There are just a few pieces to this picture that I'd like to put together, and without them, I think we'd be in trouble. The geologic landscape is like one of these Chinese or Japanese puzzles that has to be put together in sequence. It's a four-dimensional puzzle. It has three dimensions, but there's a time sequence in which the parts must be assembled. And we've left out a couple of them. One of the greatest arguments against Bretz's theory was the fact that down here in the southern portion of the basin are sediments that look suspiciously like lake sediments. Slack water, silt, and sand, rhythmically bedded, covering hundreds of square miles, not reflecting high velocity waters, but rather the ephemeral comings and goings of a lake of very large dimensions, but one which could have been fed very easily by melting glaciers to the north. Ironically, it was one of Bretz's own students who had studied the glaciers to the north and who saw the lake silts down below, who said these are not the product of a catastrophic flood, and that these are the result instead of more normal geologic agencies operating with an unusual area in between. And the battle that raged for 30 years between student and teacher, working in the same areas, reaching a loggerheads opposition in interpretation of the area, has just been resolved within the last year, and has vindicated both of them in that we have found during the last year around the margins of what Flint called the lake, tiny fossil mollusks, some of them no bigger than the lead of your pencil, some of them mollusks which require an intermediate fish as the larval host, but all of which dictate that we could not be talking about water accumulated during a two-week flood, but that we must have been talking about a lake which existed there for a minimum of at least a few hundred years. Because in a two-week flood, there couldn't possibly be time to develop a breeding population of mollusks and a fish population to go with it as well. You'll see those things when you cross eastern Washington. You'll see one other thing, and with this I'll close. Many of you have asked me already about white deposits that you saw driving across in road cuts. Many of you have asked about the Cascade volcanoes. They're the frosting on the cake on the Great Cascade Arch. They come at the very tail end of the sequence, even as the ice is melting back to the Canadian border from additional material welling upwards to produce giant volcanoes sitting on the back of the Cascade Arch. And one of the most spectacular of these is Glacier Peak, which you will see if you hike back towards Image Lake on an overnight trip from Holden Village. It erupted about 12 to 13,000 years ago, and we find ash from it all over eastern Washington. 3 weeks ago, we found ash, which may be the ash from Glacier Peak, that had settled out over campsite of hunters who lived in eastern Washington at the time of the eruption. And we'll be talking about these people, the first people in America, the people to whom this land really belongs, not us, next time and on Thursday. And to determine the age of the things that they have left as their heritage and our heritage, we'll also be talking about the enormous explosion of a volcano, which we call Mazama from the Indian name, which produced about 6,700 years ago volcanic ash from Crater Lake. Thursday night we'll talk about a similar eruption that altered the history of the Mediterranean due to the eruption of another volcano Just quickly to give you an idea of the magnitude of this, it covered a minimum fallout area of 450,000 square miles. Most of the ash that you see around Holden Village is not from Glacier Peak, 30 miles over the ridge. It's from Mazama at Crater Lake, 450 miles away. It blanketed all of Washington, all of Oregon, all of Idaho, southern British Columbia, southwestern Alberta, parts of Montana, northern Utah, Nevada, and California, and parts of the Pacific Ocean. So you're living in a landscape, or you're visiting a landscape, that is a very dramatic one. But it's a landscape that has given us certain opportunities in terms of the greatest hydroelectric projects in the world that have produced the system of dams on the Snake and the Columbia, the Grand Coulee Dam, the Columbia Basin Irrigation Project. And when we talk about our technology having made us independent of the landscape in which we live, I think that we should stop to think twice. Because if we destroy the balance and the web of life which we are utilizing here with this landscape, it's going to be much more difficult for us to pick up our dams and our hydroelectric projects and our irrigation projects and take them somewhere else than it was for those hunters who lived at Lynn Coulee 13,000 years ago to have taken their stone toolkit and to have gone to the Blue Mountains or to the Nevada deserts. And the flights of Apollo within the last 3 years have shown us that we really have no place else to go unless we can bring that environment with us, or unless we can create it there. Okay, next time we'll talk about the first people to utilize this environment.
In an atmosphere in which the academic air was sufficiently cleaner, that he at least received some of the accolade and appreciation that was his due. Without his ordeal and without the strutting of William Jennings Bryan and the surgery of Clarence Darrow and the sardonic eye of H.L. Mencken, none of us could be here talking about the things that we're talking about today at any of these sessions, probably. So we get to a situation in which trying to separate one of these fields from another of these fields becomes a very artificial thing. And I'll want to talk about this more later on in the week, but it's too obvious now to pass up the fact that we no longer have the luxury of medieval segmentation of ideas from one field to another field. We no longer have the luxury of sitting in our chalets ignoring what somebody said the session previously or is apt to say when I get done this afternoon. Which means perhaps that we should go back to transfer of energy intellectually as well as physically. Life and death are one. Harmony of energy constantly at the same. Nature's game. But what happened besides the Bishop of Usher? And what happened besides Darwin? And what happened besides Scopes? Well, something happened in 1969. Neil Aldrin and Buzz Aldrin set foot for the first time on the surface of another planet. And the spaceship carried with it the comment, "We came in peace for all mankind." And someone has noted subsequently, isn't it ironic that the only place in the universe where warfare is illegal by international agreement should be on the surface of the moon. And isn't it ironic that having achieved the capability of going to the moon, that we should listen to Norman Borlaug 3 weeks ago estimate that the period of severe crisis for the population of the Earth lies only between 17 and 20 years from now. Because the inexorable demands of the endless chain of the web of life are things that with an exploding population we can't ignore. And things which we have chosen not to control in spite of an exploding technology. Last night when I was thinking about things, I ran across a beautiful quotation from E.E. Cummings, who always has good things to say, like those beautiful answers that always ask other questions. I'm afraid I don't have any answers to these questions during this week here, because all of the answers that come are answers that ask questions. And the burgeoning, endless chain of questions then is the one with which we must cope, no matter what our field is, no matter what our background is, no matter what our profession is. And that's why I've chosen to call this Web of Life. To ask a couple of questions to begin with. The film that you're going to see was made as a documentary by a person who feels, as you will see quite obviously, very strongly about our relationship to our environment. It also is a film that was made for the Atomic Energy Commission. As part of mankind, as part of the web of life, as part of the endless chain, you are equally part of the responsibility that provided the technology that made this film possible. That's a pleasant thing. The question I would like you to ask is, have you ever stopped to think that you are equally part of the mankind that has made a film like this necessary? And if we follow that one step further, might I remind those of you who were here last summer that we were rather forcibly reminded at one of the discussions that those of us who call ourselves either Jews or Christians are the only ones who have a little black book upon which we rely that tells us to go forth and conquer the earth and to use it. And so as the only ones privileged to sit here with a license to destroy, maybe we should take a little bit of a look at what it is that we've been destroying. But if you can't see the blackboard, you're probably going to be lost in four gears. You might want to move around so that you can see the blackboard. We've got a problem making the thing stand up. It seems to be the recommended way for making it stand up. At least this was what was advised to me. That apparently it's fallen on a few people when it's been set up otherwise. Thank you.
Just by way of review, last time, which was yesterday morning at this time, we looked at a motion picture called The Web of Life or The Endless Chain by Tom Beamer, a film producer who lives in Leavenworth, just a few miles from Chelan. And in that film, Tom had tried to point out that all of us, whether we like it or not, are part of the endless chain that comprises the web of life and distribution of energy on Earth. And that this is not only a role which for us is inescapable, but one which for all life on Earth is inescapable. And that very recently we've acquired an alarming capacity to disrupt the balance in that energy chain, to bring it to the breaking point in many instances, and that by destroying one link after another of the chains which make up this web, we're very seriously endangering the existence of the web itself. I mentioned that last year it had been pointed out to us in about this time of year in one of the discussions here that those of us who consider ourselves to be either Jewish or Christian or who have been influenced by these faiths are the only people on earth who have a book to whom they turn, which they interpret to authorize them to go forth and have dominance over the earth, and the birds and the beasts of the field will be subservient to you. Which of course is correct. They have no choice, particularly given the technology that we have developed. But it is as much a question laid at our feet as to whether we ought not share pride in the technology that permitted something like the film that we saw last time to be developed, but whether we ought not recognize that as part of humanity we share responsibility for the fact that a film like that had to be made. And that we should go from the pronouncements on which we rely that the earth is ours for our exploitation, to the observation very carefully made 3 weeks ago by Norman Borlaug, recipient of the Nobel Prize for his contributions to the enrichment of wheat for the world and the alleviation of the plight of starving peoples, that the best calculations that are possible to make now project a major crisis in food for the world within the next 17 to 20 years. Norman Borlaug is not a sensationalist. Any of you who've read anything about it, any of you who've had the opportunity to hear him speak, whether it be live or on tape or TV or movie, would be impressed by exactly the opposite. One of his great attributes is his humility and his dedication. So that we're talking about something which is not simply a gimmick to be bandied about. What we're talking about is something that faces us on a very real basis. And as I pointed out also yesterday, I don't pretend to provide you with any answers. I wish that I could. I may raise some questions, but even if I could give you the answers, they'd be the kind that E. Cummings wrote about when he talked about those beautiful answers who only raise other questions. And this is not only then the web of life, this is the web of thought that has set man apart, perhaps. What I'd like to do this morning is to try a very different tack, to talk about some very specific things, to perhaps illustrate some more general things. More general things like the fact that those of you folk who come from Iowa and Illinois and Wisconsin and Minnesota raise corn and the related crops that you do because of the environment which permits you to do that, which permits you to do so with an almost unexcelled capacity in relationship to anywhere else in the world. We do the same thing here in eastern Washington with the wheat. There's no place in the world that has a greater bushel per acre yield of wheat than the Whitman County area of eastern Washington. It's noteworthy that in eastern Washington, in Whitman County, with the advent of increased technology, improved fertilizers, insect retardant sprays, and all the adjuncts of modern agriculture, that the top bushel per acre yield of wheat remains essentially what it was when the ground was broken in 1890. Mm-hmm. Similar figures might be assessed for the Midwest for a good many crops. In other words, the best we are being able to do with our management of our land is to hold our own in some of the richest places in the world. This means that the ultimate limits imposed on what we are able to do in these areas have in large part been imposed upon the potential that was there when we started, and that what we have done primarily with this potential is to degrade it. If you were to take a map and you were to plot for the Midwest the bushel per acre yield of corn, there would be a curious hole in the distribution pattern. In Wisconsin, in an area that geologists call the Driftless Area, and they call it the Driftless Area because there's no glacial drift there. Glacial drift is comprised of the debris that was carried southward out of Canada by the glaciers and then dumped. And this, by and large, or the wind-blown materials wafted from it as the outwash from the melting ice was spilling over its banks and leaving silt. These are the materials on which you're raising the corn in the Midwest. And in the area which was not glaciated the last time around, and which was not given the benefit of these weathering products from your neighbors in Canada, those of you who did not receive that are the ones who cannot raise corn. Well, here in eastern Washington, we have a similar situation. And between those of you in the Midwest and those of us here in Washington lie the remainder of the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains and the intervening mountain basins. And it's no accident, as I hope I can show you, that those of you who drove, or those of you who took the train, we'll start out with those of you who drove, followed the same routes that were followed in the early days by the trains. The trains followed the same routes that were followed in the early days by the wagon trains. The wagon trains followed the same routes that were followed in the early days by the Indians, and the Indians followed the same routes that were followed even before the advent of man into the New World by the buffalo. And they did so for the very same reasons. As a matter of fact, our airline flights now come very close to paralleling those, because our economy on the ground is still determined by those features on the ground, in spite of the fact that the plane may be independent of the ups and downs of the topography. And these factors are the factors of the inherent characteristic of the landscape in which you find yourself. The mineral resources that are available, the soils, vegetable resources in terms of the ecology of the area that is there. For the Indian, it was the buffalo. And with this, the presence or absence or the amount of the equality of water. Now there's, fortunately for us, no more exciting time to be living at the present than the present in terms of the geologic past. The present is the most excitingly diverse landscape the world has seen at any time since the Permian hundreds of millions of years ago. And in this excitingly diverse landscape, we have a few areas, like New Zealand, like Northern California, like Oregon, and like Washington, in which this diversity is brought to its fullest extent. In Washington, we go within the distance of a few hundred miles from here to the west, to the rainforest, to the Cascade Peninsula. We go within a few tens of miles to the east, to the very driest portion of the state, where annual precipitation is less than 8 inches a year. And our lives in this part of the state are governed accordingly. Perhaps more dramatically here than they are for you at home if you live in another state. But if they are more dramatically illustrated here, perhaps the point can be made more convincingly here, that your life is as wrapped up in your landscape where you live as ours is here. So what I want to do this morning is quite simply to try to build for you a landscape in answer to a question that I posed yesterday, and that was whether anybody had any concept, as the bulldozer rumbled through the terrain of the Hanford Reservation to the south of us in the motion picture yesterday, if any of you had any concept how long it had taken to make that landscape and create the ecological situation that was destroyed as you watched within a space of about 45 seconds on film. Well, the answer to that is that if we were to understand the landscape of eastern Washington at all, the very minimum length of time that we can go back is about 15 million years, to a time that geologists call Miocene, in the middle of what they also call the tertiary span of geologic time. And if we had been here then, there would have been no Cascades where we are now. There would have been instead simply the stumps or the roots of some very deeply deformed rocks from an earlier mountain chain that had been eroded almost completely away. And these low rolling hills would have extended northward to what we now call British Columbia and the Okanagan Highlands of Washington, eastward to the Bitterroot Range, or what now forms the Panhandle of northern Idaho, where also we are dealing with rocks that are very, very highly contorted and have been intruded by other rocks of granitic composition to produce a landscape that has not changed very much from what it appears today. So they were talking about a broad saucer-shaped basin that would have extended from about the point where Grand Coulee is now, you've been to Grand Coulee Dam, southward into central Oregon and westward from where we are now, or at the west where we are now, eastward to the Idaho Panhandle and the Washington-Idaho border. The rocks that produced these are even earlier, and they're so old that maybe we can ignore them for our purposes this morning. They go back to Precambrian time, the time before life on the Earth. The closest counterparts with which you might be familiar with are the rocks that make up Glacier National Park. Over in this area, in eastern Washington where I live, they're very highly contorted and scarcely recognizable, but they're of that antiquity. Well, into this broad saucer-shaped basin, during the Miocene, there welled up great floods of molten rock, or magma, known as basalt, which gradually found itself from far beneath the surface of the earth, welling upward into the bottom of this broad saucer-shaped basin. And as flow after flow would take place, the rocks erupting to produce these flows came out, not as the clinkers and cinders that we normally consider as characteristic of volcanoes like Rainier or Glacier Peak, just off to the west of us, But instead of great floods of hundreds or even thousands of cubic miles of molten rock that was extremely fluid and spread out like syrup on a platter. The result then is not a cone of the sort that you're familiar with, but a great layer cake of lava flow after lava flow after lava flow extending over a span of more than 10 million years. The result then, of course, is to produce a plateau, and you are sitting here just west of the margin of one of the three great lava plateaus of the world. The other one best preserved today is the Deccan Plateau in India. And these lavas, as they poured forth, obviously destroyed the landscape which they covered. This is something of enormous importance. First of all, it's necessary to realize the magnitude of these flows. Any one of these flows might represent a volume equal to the total volume of Mount Rainier. And there are hundreds of them. Another thing to realize is that back during this period of time, since there were no cascades where we are to block the flow of normal carrying of moist air from the Pacific inland, there was no rain shadow as we see now in the Cascades. There was no wet west side and arid eastern side. The cool, moist winds from the Pacific were carried inland, and their precipitation took place. And the water from all of this area originally flowed down into the central portion of the basin. This is now impossible because we've filled the basin with basaltic lavas to depths of thousands of feet. The original courses of the streams are destroyed as the lavas back up into the reentrant valleys around the margin . Those former drainage ways have been totally buried and engulfed. One of the products of this, of course, is the obvious one, to dam up streams around the margins. And so around the margins of this basalt plateau, lake after lake after lake formed at the mouth of each of these little tributary valleys. And at one time, a lake that formed hundreds of square miles extended over a large portion of the central part of the basin. For the basin had begun to sag. The crust of the earth is not a rigid thing. It's flexible. Under the weight of these thousands of cubic miles of basalt, it had begun to sag, and in the basining, it was trapping the water that was flowing out of the cascades around the margin. Well, this is an important event, because in that basin, we find a remarkable assemblage of fossil woods. Fossil woods of species that are confined now only to Asia, like the ginkgo, which survived perhaps only because it was cultivated on the temple grounds in China. Metasequoia, the dawn redwood that was discovered just about the end of World War II in the mountain highlands of China. Our own sequoia, sempervirens and gigantea, confined to little patches, one in Sierra Nevada, another along the California coast. Together with oak and hickory and walnut, the woods that we associate with the hardwood forests of the southeastern United States at the present time, and even the cypress and the swamp flora that we would associate with the marginal areas of the Gulf and Alabama and Florida. And they're all here, concentrated within this lake, which because of its exposure in fossil form now, near the little town of Vantage, dead in the center of the state, we call Geologic Lake Vantage, or Miocene Lake Vantage. Well, how did they get there? Well, the cypress swamps obviously were located around the margins of the lake. And as a matter of fact, in the fossilized wood, we find material that the rock hounds call bog material, and in it that you can see the seeds of the grass, the little twigs, some of them that have been saturated and bent as they sank to the bottom. And on the lowlands, around here, the hardwood forests, and up to the north in what is now British Columbia, the conifers, the Doug fir, spruce, pine. And at springtime, all of these, just as happens along the Columbia at the present time, would, in the raging torrents of meltwater running off, be carried downstream into Lake Vantage,
for they would accumulate as great rafts of logs with species that have ecological requirements totally incompatible with each other, lying side by side, the bark skimmed off, and when the next lava flow came out, it covered the sediments of Lake Vantage. The lake was gone, and the seeds and the leaves and the trunks of the trees that had accumulated within the lake were buried with it. There's no other fossil forest in the world that approaches this. There have been more than 230 species recognized from it, and from this we have then an idea of the climate during the Tertiary. I said you are living at the most excitingly diverse time that there has been since the end of the Permian. In the Tertiary this would not have been so, because this climate extended into Asia over most of the Northern Hemisphere and Europe to produce an almost monotonously similar environment, quite unlike the one that we see here, but one which brought together these very diverse floristic elements that we find preserved in the fossils just a few miles to the south. Well, the fact that they are there means we had precipitation that was on the order of 35 to 40 inches annual. The nature of their growth ring shows that seasonal variation was limited. And we see characteristics that mean something drastic has happened during the interim to produce the landscape as we know it. This something began to happen towards the end of the Miocene. The first thing that we need to talk about, though, towards the end of the Miocene, is what happened to the drainage that was destroyed when the basin was filled. And you can probably second guess me on that, as the lakes would begin to form around the margin, backing up northward and eastward into the surrounding basins. They would spill over from one basin into the next basin, until gradually they had reformed a stream that found its way around the western margin of the plateau at the gutter formed between the lava flows that poured out from the Blewett Pass area near Wenatchee and the flows that poured out from fissures in the central portion of the basin. And as they did so, gradually found their way out and ultimately, of course, to the Pacific Ocean. They effectively siphoned off all the moisture that was being delivered to the eastern portion of the state from all the areas around it. And the same thing happened to the Snake River to the south, so that the Snake River now flows northward out of Idaho, collects all the precipitation from the Grand Ronde coming in from Oregon and the Clearwater from Idaho, and comes over and meets the Columbia, and itself is carried off down the Pacific. This is something that is enormously important because it dictates almost every facet of our economic fact of life in the state of Washington in the eastern half. Well, at the same time that the Columbia was being reformed, reborn in terms of a course, the sagging of the basalt flows was having an effect on the form of the lava itself, much as though if you took rubber and stretched it across the head of a drum and pushed down on it hard, developed wrinkles tangentially radiating inward from the edge of the drum. And so the lava flows began to buckle, and as they began to buckle, in some places they formed great ridges through which the Columbia was able to cut itself a channel. And as the Columbia cut itself a channel, it maintained things that are now called watercourses, indicating that the stream was there before the ridges formed, because the stream could not have flowed up over the top of the ridge and down the other side in order to whittle its way down. So these are the classic examples of what geologists know as antecedent streams. The stream was there first, the structure came second when the stream cut its way through. It's important to note that it did so in these places, because other areas further downstream, the rising anticlinal ridges grew too fast for the Columbia to keep pace, and they produced dams. And these dams, in turn, backed up water, which produced lakes, which deposited sediment in the structural basins
of the central portion of the plateau. And as the prevailing southwesterly winds would blow across this area, especially at spring during flood time, they would pick up the fine-grained materials from the streams meandering into the lake basins. This material would be picked up, carried through the air, and then as it would rain in eastern Washington, it would be deposited over the landscape to form the peculiar rolling topography that is so enormously rich in the production of wheat and peas that we call the Palouse Hills. And thus the entire landscape, with the exception of a few of these old mountain ridges that stuck up above the basalt, the entire landscape is blanketed not only with basalt, but with the wind-blown material known as loess. And it is on these fertile loess soils that we raise the wheat and the peas, for which that part of the state is famous. Well, this gets us to the end of the Miocene. It gets us into the next period of geologic time called the Pliocene. And in our transition from one period of time to another, we undergo a very subtle initially, but very far-reaching change. That is over to the west here. In the process of the folding of these ridges of basalt, there also is the beginning of an upwarping of a great arch, which we call the Cascade Arch, that uplifted the roots of the old, worn-down, ancestral mountain system along a belt which actually extends all the way from Tierra del Fuego in South America, up the Cordillera of South America, up the backbone of the Pacific coast, the Sierra Nevada, the Cascades, up on through British Columbia, and finally out onto the Alaska Peninsula. And with the uplift of the Cascade Arch came the gradual shutting off of the water supply once delivered to eastern Washington from the Pacific Ocean. Whereas the mountains began to rise not only in the Cascades but in the Olympics to the west, the moisture was forced up over those mountains as it was forced up over the mountains to elevations which now exceed 8,000 to 9,000 feet. Precipitation was wrung from them by the cooling at high altitude, and by the time the air masses began to move down into the eastern portion of the state, the water was expanding and drying, and instead of leaving us precipitation, it was like a great sponge or a great mop coming down across the eastern portion of the state. And within a distance of less than 70 miles, we go from 90 inches or more annual precipitation along the crest of the Cascades to less than 8 inches annual precipitation in the central portion of the Columbia Basin. And the cypress swamps of the Miocene and the hardwood forests and the coniferous forests around the margin of the plateau are gone forever. And the only vestiges we see are those that have clung on in the highlands and the Cascades and the Okanagan Highlands. And instead of cypress swamps, we now have sagebrush and bunch grass and the vegetation that those of you who were here yesterday saw in Tom Beamer's film in Hanford. So that we've changed the total picture of possibilities for our economy in eastern Washington. We now have, as a result of the events of the Miocene, no option for water except that which falls directly on the landscape in the central portion of the plateau. For everything else is siphoned off around the gutter that has been formed by the Snake in the Columbia. And if we get 8 inches here, then 8 inches is what we have to work with. And if we have 24 inches in Whitman County, 24 inches is what we have to work with. And the only stream that flows across the central portion of the plateau wanders out like this as the Palouse River to join the Snake River, still relatively near the margin of the plateau, and the rest of the vast expanse is broken only by an occasional spring or a waterhole. And it becomes, I think, then no accident that the longest record of human habitation, longest continuous record of human habitation that we have in the Pacific Northwest is at a place called Marmarish Rock Shelter, located right at the confluence of these two rivers in the dry part of the basin. All right, for 10,000 years then, and as we discovered 3 weeks ago at another place called Lin Kuli, for perhaps as much as 12,000 or 13,000 years ago, man has been directly dependent upon his environment. And this is a fact which is not likely to change within our lifetimes or with our technology, which is the whole reason for wanting to go into this. Well, there's some other events that took place that I should talk about, and I've already used some superlatives. I've talked about the lava flows as being among the greatest that have ever occurred. I've compared them to the Deccan Plateau, one of the three great lava plateaus of the world. If we were to go elsewhere to look for a model, we'd have to go to the mare surfaces of the moon, the great lava plains on which the first three Apollo missions landed. I've also talked about one of the most spectacular mountain ranges within our country, the Cascades. And those of you who have the opportunity should take the North Cascades Road, which has just been opened within the past year, in order to have a glimpse of some of the finest scenery related to that. That scenery wasn't finished at the time that we stopped so far, and therefore I've got to continue a little further with it. Most of the events that have taken place so far are events that took place before the Pleistocene, or what popularly we call the Ice Age.